Yeah, sounds like some pretty nice music. And I got some nice news for you. Through the struggle, we have freed the people's lawyer, Lynn Stewart. There she was, standing, then walking slowly towards us, unshackled, without handcuffs or belly chain, and with a gigantic smile on her face. She was a sight for sore eyes, her inner and outer beauty reflected. Lynn Stewart's family, her two children, who are attorneys, a daughter who is a hospice doctor, grandchildren and great-grandchildren, along with her many supporters and attorneys, were there. WBAI radio producers, independent photographers and videographers, Prison Radio's Noel Hanrahan, and Amy Goodman of Democracy Now! Had also gathered inside LaGuardia Airport, waiting to welcome Lynn home. There were 75 to 100 supporters there. We had been waiting anxiously to see for ourselves what seemed to be too good to be true. Our Lynn, the people's lawyer, woman warrior and courageous freedom fighter, finally was coming home. And then she emerged. It was a day that many feared would never come. But we had been admonished by airport personnel not to block the elevator, staircase, or passageway. But at the sight of Lynn and her spouse, Ralph Pointer, we could no longer contain ourselves. We rushed towards her, carrying cameras, signs, and flowers, as we chanted with our big smiles and carrying tears of joy. We surrounded her. Many hugs, kisses, congratulations, and thanks were exchanged. Passerbys whispered, "I wonder who that celebrity is they're all greeting." When asked how she felt, Lynn said, "There isn't nothing like freedom." She talked about being very tired and said that she was surprised about her release and that she was getting to the point of giving up hope. She was notified of her approved release on the morning of December 31st, New Year's Eve, by a phone call from her lawyer in France and by prison officials. Everything quickly happened at that point. Lynn laughed and stated, "When the warden told me I was leaving that day, he literally threw me out of the prison." What had occurred during the previous 24 hours seems unbelievable. First, we, her supporters, heard on the morning of December 31st that U.S. Justice Department had ordered that 74-year-old Lynn Stewart be granted a compassionate release due to her terminal illness. Her 10-year sentence for aiding and abetting a terrorist organization was also reduced to time served. Since 2012, breast cancer has metastasized throughout Lynn's body, due in part to delayed medical care in prison. Lynn had filed a written request for medical release at the beginning of 2013. Her doctors say now she has approximately 12 months to live. During the course of one day, we witnessed what the Justice Department, the Director of the Federal Prisons of Bureau of Prisons, and the Manhattan federal judge could have done months ago, namely, freed Lynn Stewart. They may have just decided that they didn't want her to die in prison. They might incur some bad publicity for a so-called democratic country. Lynn Stewart's case, part of a global struggle. Lynn's case is known internationally. It's part of a global movement for social justice. We know that expecting the heartless to have a heart or evildoers to have a conscience is beyond reason and logic. The powers that be are utterly shameless. As December 31st unfolded, we learned that Lynn's release from prison was imminent. Meanwhile, Ralph, her husband, was airborne and on his way to Fort Worth, Texas to visit Lynn, as he had done routinely since her imprisonment there. It was not until after his plane landed that he got the call informing him of Lynn's fully approved compassionate release. One can only imagine his shock when he got to the prison and saw Lynn sitting in a car in a parking lot. By 9 p.m. on New Year's Eve, Ralph called into his hotel room with Lynn at his side. This moment was captured by fellow activist and producer Bob Lederer on the air at KPFA Radio. When he telephoned Ralph to interview him about the day's events, unknown to him and the listeners was that he would also be speaking on the air with Lynn herself. When we were fortunate enough to see how Lynn's release impacted Ralph the next day, when the plane carrying him and Lynn landed in New York City, Ralph was standing tall with Lynn, grinning from ear to ear. Lynn described her freedom and coming home as sunlight bursting on me. Yesterday, at this time, I was deep in the dungeons. Prisons are loveless, she said. Lynn repeatedly expressed her gratitude for the, quote, tremendous support from the tens of thousands of people in New York and the country and worldwide, unquote. Safe at her son's home in Brooklyn, where she will live, surrounded by a loving family and friends, Lynn described her 4 years in prison as horrible. She told of barely surviving the life-threatening chemotherapy treatments. She stressed that she won't forget the women that she left behind in the prison, and that she'll fight for criminal justice system reforms. We also reflect back to the many weeks last summer that Ralph stood in front of the White House in Washington, D.C., in the rain and the sweltering heat, with his signs, banners, and leaflets speaking to anyone who would listen about Lynn's plight. He and some supporters protested in front of the U.S. Justice Department against the director's refusal to approve Lynn's request for compassionate release. Ralph said he saw no acceptable alternative other than to fight like hell for Lynn's release. His unwavering love, spirit, strength, and determination were contagious. How could anyone, knowing him or Lynn, not join the struggle or give up? January 1st began a new year. What better way to start the year than to see the fruits of our labor realized, to have achieved a tortuous, long-fought-for victory, to see our hopes become a reality. We dreamed what seemed the impossible dream and saw it come true. On January the 1st, Lynn reported in person to the Office of Probation, which was mandatory within 72 hours of her release. All conditions of her release are not yet known. Yet, their ramifications may put her in the position of walking a tightrope. When Noel Hanrahan of Prison Radio arranged for Mumia Abdul-Jamal to speak to Lynn by phone, she could not speak to him for fear of violating conditions of her release. To paraphrase a statement, freedom ain't necessarily free. Lynn's courage and principle stand have been inspirational. Ralph and Lynn took a firm stand against the government and the powers that be. Their position allowed us to stand too and fight back. with and for them. The road ahead will be anything but smooth. Lynn faces more medical treatment as she fights for her life. She will make appointments with Sloan Kettering, New York's leading cancer center, and submit her medical records to them. She says she looks forward to beating the odds. I've fought lions and tigers, and I won't let cancer get me. As we celebrate a victory over a tragic injustice, there are many more victories to achieve. We must free all our political prisoners. Lynn urges us to take action on their behalf. She states, fight on, resist, resist, resist. It makes life worth living. Power from the people made my release happen. She adds that she's skeptical but hopeful for better future changes. A better world is possible and we must make it happen. La lucha continua. Okay, so they let Lynn out. That's good. Just check this one song out by Steel Pulse.
High techs and gun backs for military defense. I say doctors are the falling angels.
No water.
Quench eternal flames of hell.
Hellfire.
I say doctors are the falling angels.
No water.
To quench eternal flames of hell.
Hellfire. Earth crisis.
Thank you.
right, we're back. We're back. This, you're listening to the round sounds of 104.1 Berkeley Liberation Radio. I'm Gerald, and this program is called Radical Perspectives. And right now, we're going to let you know, this program specializes in news that you can use. So, we're going to be telling you now about the turmoil in the Ukraine. It looks like what we have is a squalid situation where the capitalist powers are in a tug of war. And the United States, once again, is in the mix. Fascists mobilized behind USUE against Russia. Since the end of November, tens of thousands of demonstrators have repeatedly flocked to Maidan Square in the Ukraine capital of Kiev, protesting the refusal of President Viktor Yanukovych to sign an association agreement with the European Union. Leading bourgeois politicians from the capitalist West, such as the American Senator John McClain and EU Foreign Affairs Representative Catherine Ashton, flooded into Kiev to solidarize with the protesters. In some ways, it was a reprise of the so-called Orange Revolution of 2004, when the U.S. and other imperialists, backed by a phoenix of imperialist-funded organizations, financed and engineered demonstrations that forced the election of a pro-Western, anti-Russian president. And his name was Viktor Yushchenko. Okay, so the two Victors, apparently. The person who's president now is Viktor Yanukovych. Okay? The ongoing aim of the Western imperialists is to establish a client state on the border of Russia, which, under the rule of capitalist strongman Vladimir Putin, has increasingly become a thorn in their sides. And Ukraine would be a big prize. Its industrial base supplies the Russian market, and its Black Sea and Crimean Peninsula territories are of strategic importance to the Russian military. The protesters and their imperialist backers claimed that they were fighting for the alleged higher values of European culture and civilization. A measure of those so-called values is the major role played in recent protests by outright fascists belonging to the, now let me see if I pronounce this properly, Sloboda Party. This organization derives from the Ukrainian nationalists led by Stefan Bandera, who carried out mass murders of Jews, Reds, Soviet soldiers, and Poles during World War II. Wow. Underlining their rabid anti-communism, the fascists spearheaded the destruction of a statue of V.I. Vladimir Ilyich Lenin, whose Bolshevik party led the Russian October Revolution in 1917 that liberated the toilers and subjected peoples of the former Tsarist Empire, that is Jews, Azerbaijanis, Ukrainians, etc., from capitalist and landlord oppression. After renewed protests last weekend erupted into pitched battles between riot police and balaclava-wearing men armed with steel pipes and firebombs, some reports pointed to the involvement of the right sector, which, according to the BBC, that is the British Broadcasting Company, on the 21st of January, they said they considered Sloboda too liberal and conformists. Last month, while McCain was shaking hands with Slavoboda leader Oleg Tyanovich, the Obama administration dispatched Victoria Nuland, Assistant Secretary of State for European and Eurasian Affairs, to Kiev. Nuland emphasized, and I quote, "We stand with the people of the Ukraine who see their future in Europe." At the same time, she stated that, quote, "the rule of law must be upheld," unquote, which was understood by protest leaders to indicate U.S. reluctance to sponsor a forcible overthrow of the Yanukovych regime. No, I mean, there have been thousands of people rallying in Kiev. And it's interesting now that to find out that these forces, including the Slavoboda fascists, right? Senator McCain is running there, shaking people's hands and carrying on, but this is some serious stuff. Okay. Just one second.
The struggle continues. German coming through.
Ooh, yeah.
The struggle continues.
Ooh,
the struggle continues. Rip it up.
Ooh, yeah. Well, all right, well, tell me. I wanna tell it with you. We're jamming, jamming, and I hope you like jamming too. There are rules, ain't no vows. We can do it anyhow. I and I will see you through. 'Cause every day we pay the price. We're living sacrifice. Jamming till the time is through. We're jamming,
jamming.
The thing that jamming was the thing of a band. We're jamming. And I hope the time is gonna last.
We jamming on the one for the daughters and son. Know the struggle is not over till the battle is won. Hip-hop is life, but it ain't all to me. Now, where will we be if they take our mic from we? Or better yet, strip us from life itself.
Okay, I'm back.
I've done it before, so I sit behind the door. Those that claim but don't really know the game. Bob Marley, learn the man behind the name.
Yeah. Holy Mount Zion. Holy Mount Zion, yeah, just seated in Mount Zion, it rules all creation. Yeah, we're jamming up to our wall. We're jamming,
we're jamming,
we're jamming, we're jamming, we're jamming, we're jamming, we're jamming. Hope you like jamming.
Yeah, we're jamming.
Hope you like jamming too.
Yes, we're jamming.
Hope you like jamming too.
We're jamming.
Hope you like jamming too.
We be jamming.
Hope you like jamming.
Okay, now we're trying to wrap our heads around this Ukraine mess. I tell you what clarifies things for us very quickly, and that's the involvement of the United States government. Because we know, after observing this last period, be it Libya, Syria, Iraq, intervention by the United States government ain't nothing good. Now, such hesitation is a measure of Washington's. They're hesitating to be involved, see? Because they don't know what's going to happen. And such hesitation is a measure of Washington's difficulty in pursuing its strategic interests around the world, not least its dealings with a more assertive Russian government. You see, Russia ain't no joke. There was capitalist restoration in Russia, for sure. But it still remains a fairly substantive country. So today's Russia, which was formerly the Soviet Union, emboldened the U.S. imperialists when capitalism was restored in Russia. No longer challenged by the Soviet military might in their depredations. On top of attempting to install pliant regimes through a series of color so-called revolutions in former Soviet republics, the U.S. has established bases across Central Asia and elsewhere in Russia's periphery. This military extension is aimed at the encirclement not only of capitalist Russia, still the world's second largest nuclear power, but also China, the largest and most powerful of the remaining bureaucratically deformed worker states. So you got that dynamic going on. They want to keep an eye on China. They like to have their military bases close to China. They got them close to Russia. And then, to tell you the truth, the different capitalists don't trust each other. Look at this NSA stuff. So there's constant rivalries between France and the United States, Germany and France, and on and on. The Ukraine is politically polarized between competing cliques of capitalist tycoons who enriched themselves at the expense of the working masses by grabbing the industrial wealth that had once been collectivized property in the Soviet Union. Yanukovych's support derives from eastern Ukraine and Crimea. His son, Alexandra, one of the richest men in the country, has substantial interest in construction, banking, and coal mining. Other oligarchs, with an appetite for more European investment, orient towards the UE. Okay, so now we're starting to see, we're a little clearer. What is it that's causing this conflict? All right, there are different sectors of the capitalist class. Those that already deal with the European Union, UE, and the United States, and have a relationship with them, want to go with the UE. Those that are more nationally based, construction, obviously, that's a national pursuit. You know, coal mining, you know? So I can see they have different outlooks because and different perspectives because they are based on different sectors of the economy. Both sides have demagogically stirred up antagonisms between the heavily Russified and Orthodox Eastern Ukraine, where the bulk of industry is located, and the more rural and the Uniate Catholic Western Ukraine, long a breeding ground of Ukrainian nationalism. Participants in the recent protests in Kiev, which is located in the center of the country, were heavily drawn from Galicia and other areas of Western Ukraine. Okay, now that's evolved over time, you see. Commenting on the European Union's proposed agreement with the Ukraine, one Western diplomat in Kiev bluntly admitted that, quote, "These association agreements reflect a kind of colonial attitude," unquote. Going to the note that the deal, and here it is, quote, "is far more advantageous for European investors than it is for Ukrainian businesses," unquote. In fact, the real losers would be the working people of the Ukraine. A free trade deal with the UE, or European Union, would lead to mass factory closures and layoffs, particularly in the eastern part of the country, where production of steel, metals, railway cars, and nuclear equipment is ill-equipped to compete with industry in Germany, for instance. It would also imperil Ukraine's massive oil and gas imports from Russia. As an imperialist trade bloc dominated by Germany, the European Union necessarily exploits the working classes of Europe and oppresses its weaker, more dependent countries. Having put the Greeks, the Irish, the Portuguese et al. On starvation rations, Angela Merkel and company, that is the leader of Germany, have no intention of making concessions to poverty-stricken Ukraine. And with its 46 million inhabitants, okay? Indeed, Ukrainians were not to be given even the alleged rights of EU membership. Thus, while the capitalists would have the right to invest and export goods to the Ukraine, its population would have no right to travel and work in the European Union. See, that's the way it works. If your country is a part of the European Union, your passport is recognized by every other country that is part of the Union. So the people, if they need to go work, let's say in England, there's work, they can go to England and work. Okay? But they're not even guaranteed that much with the current agreement. Ukrainians were not given even the alleged rights of UE membership. You see that? Moreover, the EU agreement was tied to an International Monetary Fund loan that mandated an austerity diet, including budget cuts and the slashing of gas and oil subsidies, without which many would not be able to heat their own homes in the frigid winter. Now, I'm going to tell you something. In Russia, they be having some cold. It's cold. I'm talking serious cold. And in the Ukraine, you know, their parts of the Ukraine is very cold. So not being able to get oil, that's a serious consideration. As the Western states increased their pressure, Putin played hardball with the Ukrainian government, threatening to end Russian trade preferences if the UE agreement was signed. He later offered concessions, including a loan of up to $15 billion and a one-third price cut for gas. It was an offer that the Ukrainian government could not afford to turn down. While offering a temporary reprieve, the Russian deal will not in any way put an end to mass poverty, which is rooted in capitalist exploitation. But the maneuver cut the ground out from under the opposition, temporarily dissipating the protests. Subsequently, the United States Senate passed the resolution that denounced, and I quote, Russian economic coercion, unquote, and threatened Ukraine with sanctions in the event of further state violence against pro-UE demonstrators, presumably including the fascists. And now, European and American spokesmen are up in arms over laws just enacted by Yanukovych, the current president, cracking down on protests. Nevertheless, it is widely conceded that Putin won a victory this round, albeit one that is financially risky. The New York Times of December the 17th, 2013, noted the following, and I'm going to quote that. For Mr. Putin, the jostling over the Ukraine is the latest of several foreign policy moves that have served to reestablish Russia as a counterweight to Western dominance of world affairs. The Times has also mentioned that Putin's defiance of Washington is granting Edward Snowden temporary asylum, and his deflection of a U.S. military strike in Syria with a proposal to eliminate Syria's chemical weapons. That was Putin that pulled that stroke, that statesman-like stroke. He got the Syrian regime to agree to get rid of the chemical weapons, which undermined the Americans' desire, Obama and his regime's desire to bomb the country. Okay. Now, there are fascists in operating. They call this a Banderiite. The fascists of Svoboda are hardly a fringe phenomenon. In the 2012 elections, it received over 10% of the vote, giving it 38 out of 450 seats in Ukraine's parliament. With a base in the western part of the country, Svoboda is recognized as part of an anti-Yanukovych coalition by the other main opposition forces. The Udar Party, led by retired boxer Vitali Klitschko, and the Fatherland Coalition, associated with the former Prime Minister Yulia Tymoshenko, a darling of Western media, who amassed a fortune in insider deals on the gas contracts and is now in prison, convicted of, quote, the abuse of power, unquote, while hypocritically denouncing Putin for interfering in Ukraine's internal affairs. The UE demanded the release of Tymoshenko as a condition for its deal. Until 2004, Svoboda was called the Social Nationalist Party, a reference to the National Socialism of the Nazis, and held a swastika-like logo. That year, Svoboda leader Tyanukovych made a notorious speech denouncing the, and I quote, Jewish Russian mafia, unquote, that supposedly ran the Ukraine. Svoboda maintains ties with other fascist parties in Europe, like the British National Party. In 2012, a Svoboda lawmaker said that Ukrainian-born Hollywood actress Mila Kunis was not a, quote, true Ukrainian, calling her a, dig this, quote, dirty Jewess, meaning female Jew. Ukrainian nationalism has always had a strong anti-Semitic coloration, while subordinating itself to one or another greater capitalist power. At the time of the October Revolution and the Civil War that followed it, Ukrainian nationalists allied with a series of reactionary forces against the Bolsheviks, including the Kaiser's Germany, Russian White Guards, and Imperialist France. Finally, the Ukrainian nationalist Simon Petlura, notorious for massacres of the Jewish population in western Ukraine, made a bloc with the Polish nationalists, Józef Pelstucki, ceding the western territories to Poland. This land grab, consolidated through the 1920 Soviet-Polish War, effectively partitioned Ukraine, with the eastern region adhering to a new proletarian power established by the October Revolution of 1917. The Ukrainian fascists later allied with Nazi Germany. On January 1st of this year, Svoboda staged the 15,000-strong march in Kiev to celebrate the birthday of fascist nationalist Stepan Bandera. Openly flaunting their fascist sympathies. They supported the red, black, blood and soil banners carried by Bandera's forces. Many wore the uniforms of the Ukrainian insurgent army, which was founded in collaboration with the German Weimar in Soviet-occupied Western Ukraine in 1940 to fight against the Red Army. All wings of Ukrainian bourgeois nationalism collaborated with Hitler when he invaded the country in 1941. The Nazis quickly revealed that they had little regard for Slavic subhumans, they called them. I can't pronounce the German word Untermenschen, and even less for Ukrainian independence. So one wonders, well, why in the hell would these nationalists work with the Nazis, given that they felt like, I'm talking about the German Nazis, given that they felt like that. Nationalist sentiment quickly turned against the Germans. Nonetheless, the UPA, which by 1942 was dominated by Bandera's wing of the Organization of Ukrainian Nationalists, spent more time fighting the anti-fascist Soviet partisans than it did the German forces. Bandera was, quote, rehabilitated, unquote, by the Germans in 1944, by which time the Soviets had regained control of much of eastern Ukraine. The Nazis hoped the Ukrainian nationalists could stop the advance of the Red Army. Bandera set up a headquarters in Berlin and oversaw the training of the Ukrainians by the Weimar. The UPA, that is that Ukrainian, you know, anti-Soviet army, not only carried out atrocities against Jews and communists, but also butchered tens of thousands of Poles. Its all-pervasive anti-Semitism was described in the memoirs of Mikhail Belatsky, a Jewish Ukrainian Trotskyist who was imprisoned by Stalin's bureaucratic regime in the Verkhoda labor camp, where he encountered some of Bandera's followers in the 1950s. Belatsky recounted what he learned of the activities of the Banderaite cutthroats in the Ukraine. I will not speak, and this is a quote from him, I will not speak of the fate of the local Jews. You can imagine what happened to them. But Poles also lived up there. The Bandera forces butchered one after another all the Polish families who had not managed to go into hiding. They slaughtered them not with guns, but with sabers. They derived pleasure from hacking up the people's children with their bare hands and massacring women. And this was in the Bulletin of In Defense of Marxism. Okay. By 1947, most UPA units had escaped into the waiting arms of Western intelligence, which turned them into a guerrilla force against the Soviets. However, by 1950, they had little in the way of operational forces in the Ukraine. And in 1951, the Soviet KGB assassinated the fascist pig, Bandera. Ukrainian nationalism and counter-revolution, therefore, is a serious problem. The heroic victory of the Red Army over Hitler's Nazis set the stage for incorporating Western Ukraine into the USSR. Despite the presence of a parasitic Russian-centered Stalinist bureaucracy, the planned economy of the Soviet Union laid the basis for the advancement of minority peoples and sharply undercut nationalist forces. Less wealthy regions, such as Central Asia and also Ukraine, were economically subsidized. Okay? However, in the period of the terminal decline of the USSR, Soviet Russia, the Soviet Union, rather. Nationalist hatreds and rivalries were revived, becoming a motor force for counter-revolution. In the mid-1980s, the policy of perestroika, market reforms, by Gorbachev, right? Initiated by Soviet Premier Mikhail Gorbachev in an attempt to revive the economy, spurred decentralization, helping fuel the resurgence of long-suppressed national antagonisms. Bloody communal slaughter, such as between the Azerbaijani and Armenia, erupted. Western imperialists, who had always sought to undermine the USSR by inflaming national divisions, encouraged the growth of pro-capitalist so-called independence movements in the Balkans, in the Ukraine, and elsewhere. Fascist groups like Pomyat in Russia and the Banderaites in Western Ukraine began to crawl out of their rat holes. In the name of anti-Semitism, most of our left opponents simply caved in to the imperialist drive for capitalist counter-revolution, which triumphed in Russia in 1991, destroying the Soviet worker state. These supposed Marxists supported any and all anti-Soviet forces, including outright fascists. Not all of them, but some of the opponents. In 1991, the International Communist League representatives withdrew from the editorial board of Revolutionary History, an archival publication focusing on the Trotskyist movement. One reason was the desire of a substantial part of the editorial board to publish patently fascistic Ukrainian nationalist material. Well, okay. Flirtation with fascists in the former Soviet republics was all too common among many would-be leftists. The late Ernest Mandel's United Secretariat hailed the Estonian Nazi Forest Brothers as freedom fighters in the struggle against Stalinism. Now, there's a group called Workers' Power that was caught supporting Butchenko, who was connected to both the Russian fascists and the Scab Miners Union in Britain. Okay. The capitalist counter-revolution that dismembered the Soviet Union dealt a severe blow to the Ukrainian economy, which had been integrated into the all-union economic division of labor. Throughout the former USSR, living standards plummeted. In Ukraine, real wages were at best only one-third of the 1991 levels in 2000, and one-half by 2002. Industrial employment fell 50% between 1991 and 2001. Lacking vital natural resources and economically impoverished, capitalist Ukraine is necessarily dependent on stronger capitalist powers. Since counter-revolution, the Ukrainian bourgeoisie has been torn, with some looking to the Western imperialists and others seeking to maintain existing trade ties with Russia. So you see now the economic basis of this conflict. Okay. Excuse me. Notwithstanding the one-sided dependence of Russia's economy on natural resource extraction, the country's large nuclear arsenal gives it great power status. With the imperialists trying to subvert Russian power, Poland has worked closely with the United States, seeking to regain its former influence in the Ukraine. Putin has used the leverage provided by relatively high oil prices to pursue Russian interests in the region. The Russian bourgeoisie lords it over the minority peoples in its own backyard, as demonstrated by two bloody colonial-style wars fought to subdue predominantly Muslim Chechnya. Concerned about a possible Islamic insurgency in its southern flank, Putin was happy, the president of Russia, was happy to sign on to Bush Jr.'s so-called war on terror and negotiated a deal allowing U.S. troops bound for Afghanistan to transit through Russia. Gazprom, the Soviet-controlled gas corporation, has also been an instrument of Russia's foreign policy. Following the 2004 so-called Orange Revolution that led to the defeat of the Kremlin's favorite candidate in Ukraine, Gazprom threatened higher prices. When the Ukrainian government objected, Gazprom shut off the gas. Since most Russian gas exports to Europe go by pipeline through the Ukraine, this action also threatened the supplies of European customers. While a compromise was reached, prices went up and the Russians had made a point. Russia has also used its economic muscle with other neighboring countries. Thus, in an attempt to keep Moldova from seeking closer ties with Europe, Moscow declared a ban on imports of Moldovan wine, one of the country's major exports. Russia has also sponsored its own free trade zone, the Eurasian Customs Union, the whole purpose of which is to keep former Soviet republics in Russia's orbit and sway from the European Union. Kazakhstan and Belarus have joined. More recently, Armenia, which depends on Russian for military defense, has come on board. Membership was offered to the Ukraine in a counter to EU association agreement. However, Putin has dropped this proposal for the time being, no doubt aware that it would not fly in much of the Ukraine, particularly in the western part of the Ukraine. Almost two decades ago, this stuff broke out. And, so this is, now we understand there are different economic interests at play underneath the surface. And that is what is causing this problem in the Ukraine. Be right back. You're listening to Lady Smith Black Sambaza. Oakland's Domain Awareness Center. Recording where you're going and when, who you are and who you're with, what you're texting and tweeting, the words you speak and the words you write. An all-seeing eye throughout Oakland and its port, with surveillance primarily in areas with people of color and the poor, in public housing and public schools. This was set up not to stop crime. Surveillance has been shown to be ineffective in that. The cameras have been shown to be ineffective in terms of dealing with crime. But to create a sense of dread, track protesters, and dissuade those trying to exercise their rights to speak and assemble, touted as able to, quote, keep tabs on port labor actions, assembled by a contractor, SAIC, which defrauded New York City for $500 million and in direct violation of Oakland's nuclear free zone ordinance. It could now be integrated by another contractor, Snyder Electric, also a nuclear weapons contractor in violation of the NFZO. To be run by police who can't even follow their own policies regarding body cameras and are in federal receivership because of their civil rights violations against Oakland citizens. They will also be in charge of the DAC's so-called privacy policy, which undoubtedly will be honored only in breach. Stop the DAC before it starts. Just recently, in the Los Angeles area, on January the 13th, former Fullerton cops Manuel Romez and Jay Cicinelli, who led the police charge in the barbaric fatal beating of Kelly Thomas, a homeless white man, walked free out of court. The savagery of this 5th of July 2011 assault was captured on 33 minutes of surveillance video that show cops landing blow after blow against an unarmed Thomas who suffered from schizophrenia. This footage has sparked outrage on the streets, in the press, and on the internet, where it gained wide attention after WikiLeaks tweeted the entire video to a 2.1 million followers. As Kelly's father, Ron Thomas, himself a former Orange County Sheriff's deputy, warned, and I quote, "This is carte blanche to police officers to do whatever they want," unquote. The 2011 video shows the two officers confronting Thomas in the parking lot of a Fullerton transit station after a call to the police from a local bar was embellished with the false accusation that Thomas was trying to break into parked cars. Ramos put on latex gloves and told Thomas, "Now you see my fists? They're getting ready to fuck you up." Unquote. A gang of six cops proceeded to taser Thomas multiple times and bash his skull with the taser and batons as he cried out in pain, repeatedly apologized, and gasped that he could not breathe. Finally, he screamed, "Dad, they are killing me. Thomas, who suffered broken facial bones and a compressed thorax, was knocked into a coma and died 5 days later. In an attempt to defuse anger, a couple months after the fatal attack, Ramos was charged with murder in the second degree and involuntary manslaughter, and Cicinelli with involuntary manslaughter and excessive use of force. The murder charge was a first for an active duty cop in the conservative law and order enclave of Orange County. Charges were brought out against a third cop, but dropped shortly after the not guilty verdict was read for Ramos and Cicinelli. On January the 18th, some 200 people gathered in front of the Fullerton police station to protest the outcome of the trial. The cops responded with a show of force and ended up arresting 10 people for, quote, failure to disperse, and two for vandalism. We demand, drop the charges now. Another protester was arrested for allegedly assaulting a news videographer. Police violence is endemic to this capitalist society. Reformist socialists, though, peddle fantasies on the so-called people bringing the cops to heel. One refrain is for an all-civilian review board. As the Party for Socialism and Liberation put it, at the time the cops were charged, such a board, quote, would have the power to fire officers, impose sanctions, or even file criminal charges in cases where police act out of line. The notion that the guard dogs of the capitalist order can be cleaned up and made accountable for the exploited and oppressed masses is a dangerous lie. In fact, if the defense counsel has said one thing truthful, it was when Ramos' attorney, John Barnett, who also defended the cops involved in the 1991 beating of Rodney King, told reporters that these cops, quote, were doing their jobs. They did what they were trained to do, unquote. As the paid enforcers of capitalist rule, the cops brutalize the outcasts of this oppressive and massively unequal society, especially black and Latino youth in the inner city. Meanwhile, the capitalist masters who treat the penniless and the downtrodden, dumped in the streets as beneath contempt, take the axe to social programs for the homeless, the elderly, the mentally ill, and the disabled. Access to basic human necessities such as health care, a good education, and decent housing should be an elementary right for everyone, not just those who can afford it. But such a massive relocation of wealth and resources can be achieved only by ripping power out of the hands of the blood-sucking capitalist class and creating a socialist society where production is for human need, not for profit. For that to happen, the anger of the ghettos and the barrios would seethe daily under the boot of the thugs in blue must be linked to the social power of the multiracial working class mobilized in class struggle opposition to the capitalist state. What is needed is a revolutionary workers' party to lead the way to uprooting this system of exploitation and oppression and the cop terror that defends this system. Be right back. Now, you know, South Africa is heating up. Yours truly helped to work on a demonstration against the massacre of South African platinum miners that took place a couple of years ago now. Well, that massacre has had an impact on South Africa. And now, we are having some of the unions in South Africa come out against the ANC. Okay? There's a basic principle for human progress. If the working class is going to come together and unite and fight back, that working class needs to have its own political organization, its own political independence. The South African Communist Party, part of the ruling tripartite alliance led by the African National Congress, has long subordinated itself to the bourgeois nationalist ANC, portraying it as leading the mainly black working class and the poor in a so-called national democratic revolution. There's no revolution going on in South Africa right now. Just the most brutal exploitation, where black workers make substantially less money than their white counterparts. During the 1925-1927 Chinese Revolution, Bolshevik leader Leon Trotsky fought against the liquidation of the Chinese Communist Party into the bourgeois nationalist Kuomintang. This was a policy ordered by the Communist International leadership of J.V. Stalin and Nikolai Bukharin, with the rationale that the Kuomintang was the leader of China's national revolution. The subordination of the Chinese Communist Party to the Kuomintang, founded by Sun Yat-sen, culminated in the April 27th slaughter of tens of thousands of communists in Shanghai by forces led by Sun's successor, Chiang Kai-shek. Bourgeois society, here is what Leon Trotsky said at that time. This is an interesting quote. Excuse me. Capitalist society, or bourgeois society, as is known, is so constructed that the propertyless, discontented, and deceived masses are at the bottom, and the contented fakers remain on top. Every bourgeois party, if it is a real party, that is, if it embraces considerable masses, is built on the self-same principle. The exploiters, fakers, and despots compose the minority in class society, the 1%, right? Every capitalist party, therefore, is compelled in its internal relations, in one way or another, to reproduce and reflect the relations in bourgeois society as a whole. In every mass bourgeois party, the lower ranks are therefore more democratic and further to the left, so-called, than the party tops. Bukharin asks, and I quote, "And what about the Kuomintang masses? Are they mere cattle?" Unquote. Of course they are cattle. The masses of any bourgeois party are always cattle, although to different degrees. But for us, the masses are not cattle, are they? No. That is precisely why we are forbidden to drive them into the arms of the bourgeoisie. camouflaging the latter under the label of a workers and peasants party. That is precisely why we are forbidden to subordinate the proletarian party, the workers party, to a bourgeois party. But on the contrary, must at every step oppose the former to the latter. That is, oppose the bourgeois party by advancing the workers' party or the proletarian party. The so-called high summit of the Kuomintang, of which Bukharin speaks so ironically, as if something secondary, accidental, or temporary, is in reality the soul of the Kuomintang, its social essence. Of course, the bourgeoisie constitutes only the summit, quote-unquote, in the party as well as in society. But this summit is powerful in its capital, knowledge, and connections. It can always fall back on the imperialists for support. And what is most important, it can always resort to the actual political and military power, which is intimately fused with the leadership of the Kuomintang itself. It is precisely this summit that wrote laws against strikes, throttling the uprisings of the peasants, shoved the communists into the dark corner, and at best allowed them to be only one third of the party, exacted an oath from them that petty bourgeois Sun Yat-senism takes precedence over Marxism. The rank and file were picked and harnessed by this summit, serving it, like Moscow, as a, quote, left support, just as the generals, compradors, and imperialists served it on the right, as a right support. To consider the Kuomintang not as a bourgeois party, but as a neutral arena of struggle for the masses, to play with words about nine-tenths of the left rank and file in order to mask the question as to who is the real master, meant to add the strength and power of the summit to assist the latter to convert even broader masses into cattle, and under conditions most favorable to it, to prepare the Shanghai coup d'etat. In this, the theory of the block of classes, the theory of the Kuomintang, is a workers' and peasants' party, provides the best possible assistance for the bourgeoisie. When the bourgeoisie later comes into hostile conflict with the masses and shoots them down, in this clash between the two real forces, the bourgeoisie and the proletariat, not even the bleating of the celebrated nine-tenths is heard. The pitiful democratic fiction evaporates without a trace in face of the bloody reality of the class struggle. And that's what happened in April 1927. You see? Wow. Thoughtful. Be right back. Okay, now I just want you to know the struggle to keep the Berkeley post office open is doing much, much better. But here is the rationale for the direct defense to save the post office and the vital public sector of which it's a part. This gives you a kind of a history and an understanding of how this unfolded. Because this post office struggle is very important against privatization. Privatization means taking public resources and putting them on the market for sale. And in this case, in the case of the post office, it's crazy, but that's what they're trying to do. On April the 22nd of 2013, the U.S. Postal Service approved the so-called relocation of Berkeley's main post office and formally announced its plan to sell our historic post office building at 2000 Alston Way. On July the 18th of 2013, Tom A. Sumra, Vice President of Facilities for UPS, rejected Berkeley citizens and city council's appeals to that decision. The United States Postal Service, this is the administration, right? Rejected the people in Berkeley trying to save the post office. We will not accept this. Under the First Amendment to our Constitution, we have the right to, quote, peacefully assemble and to petition the government for a redress of grievances, unquote. We are therefore here on our building steps to demand that the United States Postal Service reverse this decision and instead provide post office services in our building at a level commensurate with the needs of our city and especially our downtown. We intend to defend our post office building and our right to post office services with our physical presence until the demand is met. What is at issue goes beyond both building and its services. At issue is the rampant privatization of public property and public services and the lack of accountability of our government to the public. Now we're talking about public property here. Our beautiful main post office building belongs to all of us. Opened in 1914, it is a crucial element in our city's design about a core of public buildings that also includes among its immediate neighbors our library, our high school, and our city hall. It was paid for by our ancestors' taxes and left to us so that using our post office would be convenient and pleasant, contributing to our civic prosperity and our connection to the nation and the world. Its architecture inspiring pride and trust in the U.S. Post Office itself. In 1937, through the New Deal's direct support of public art, the Treasury Relief Art Project, it was decorated with a mural in the main lobby. It's called Incidents in California History, depicting the earliest inhabitants of Berkeley and a bas relief on the front of the building. Post office activities depicting a group of people, including a man holding a package addressed from DS to all mankind, Truth Abode on Freedom Road. That's the mural. That's the high monetary value of our beautiful and central post office building is the acknowledged motive for its proposed sale. However, transfer of its nearly a century's worth of accumulated public value to whatever private buyer happens to have cash now and so can receive pleasure and profit from it is at best desperate bad management and at worst outright theft. Such a sale would not benefit the United States Postal Service in the long run. It would cost the United States Postal Service an asset and make it dependent upon downtown market real estate forces that have destroyed many businesses in Berkeley. The only actual beneficiary of such a sale would be whoever derives wealth from trading in and controlling that downtown real estate, and whoever can afford whatever private use our postal building might be put to, such as condominiums, restaurants, wineries, and hotels. Other historic post offices have been sold off, have already become. Our postal building belongs to us, and we must not permit it to be either squandered or stolen. It is not for sale. There are also public services that have to be considered. We need the U.S. Postal Service. Communication with people in other places is important not only for our prosperity, but also for our freedom and our happiness. Article 1, Section 8, Clause 7 of the U.S. Constitution empowers Congress to, quote, establish post offices and post roads and the U.S. Post Office has fulfilled its mission efficiently and securely for over 200 years, guided by the principles of its universal service obligation. It provides service to all U.S. residents at uniformed and affordable rates. The United States Postal Service claims to be experiencing enormous financial, quote, losses, unquote, necessitating the sale of our building and other historic post office buildings across the country. What such posted so-called losses reflect, however, is not any failure of the United States Postal Service, including any failure of it to adapt to technological developments, including that affect its mission, but rather a political assault on it as a public service. Under President Nixon, following a postal worker strike, the Postal Recognition Act of 1970, signed into law in 1971, reduced the taxpayer-funded cabinet-level post office to the current United States Postal Service, a federal agency of the executive branch, operated by an appointed board of governors as a business and funded by postage sales. In 1992, President George H. W. Bush issued Executive Order 12803, directing all federal, state, and local agencies to maximize what they call infrastructure privatization, unquote, leading to the outsourcing of many postal functions. For example, Pitney Bowles now does most of the mail sorting and wants to do more. Finally, under President George W. Bush, Congress passed the Postal Accountability and Enhancement Act of 2006, requiring the United States Postal Service to pre-fund within 10 years of all of its future health and retirement benefit payments for the next 75 years, an outrageous requirement not imposed on any other public agency or private enterprise. This is not oversight, let alone management of the post office. It is an assault on the post office. It is downright sabotage. What kind of law is that? Through all this, our actual need for a post office has not lessened. If it had, FedEx and UPS would not be able to be profitable enterprises that they are, offering similar services to the post office dependent on its infrastructure, but not bound by its USO. Package delivery is on the rise. Public internet usage is also on the rise. The post office adapted to the intervention of the telegraph and the telephone, providing these services to the public before they were economically viable as private services. And it could do the same, in the same way, provide internet services, which now costs upwards of $30 per month per household, compared to 46 cents per domestic letter. And the simple hand mailing of sealed letters, whose privacy is protected by law, has never seemed more important than in this moment. A revelation of the extent of government, NSA, for instance, surveillance of other channels of communication and the complicity of private communications corporations in that surveillance. That is, Verizon, AT&T, all of them work with the government. They hand over our phone calls, which are then stored by the NSA. From 1911 to 1967, the post office also provided public banking services, as postal services in many countries still do. Restoration of even just basic check cashing services would be an enormous relief to low-income people who, for lack of assets or documents or both, currently pay high fees, often in unsafe locations, for such services. In the long run, postal banking could facilitate the direct provision of many public financial services, such as student loans, for example, eliminating the cost of payouts to private shareholders along the way. Congress remains responsible for our post office, with the House Committee on Oversight and Government Reform, chaired by Darrell Issa, overseeing the United States Postal Service. In the U.S. Senate, Bernie Sanders, independent from Vermont, his bill, S-316, the Postal Service Protection Act, and in the House of Representatives, Pete DeFazio's, he's a Democrat from Oregon, his companion bill, H.R. 630, would remove current legislation impediments to the United States Postal Service provision of both current and imaginable future postal services, including the pre-funded benefits requirement. These are the measures required to fix the United States Postal Service's financial situation, not the sale of our post office building or others across the country. So, that's going to be it for now. I hope you enjoyed our program. I will not be here next week, but I will be here the following Saturday, March 8th, I think it is. Continue to check out our program, Radical Perspectives, here at Berkeley Liberation Radio. Thank you. I'm in the groove and I just can't stop.